Hello, I'm Christine Bywater. You are listening to part one of a three-part conversation in the series, Normal Was Never Good Enough, Resisting the Return to What Was. On this episode, Centering Relationships for a Restorative Restart, we speak with three guests about how the pandemic has exposed long-standing systemic inequities in education that has cost lives and livelihoods and families already vulnerable and on the edge. And what should we do about it? What will it take to rebuild or recover? And what actions should districts and school leaders take to prioritize building and nurturing relationships among students, families, and educators to ensure we don't return to a pre-pandemic normal that wasn't working? Resources mentioned during the episode, as well as additional resources, can be found under the Resources tab at our website, cset.stanford.edu. This series was created in collaboration with the Center to Support Excellence in Teaching and the Policy Analysis for California Education at Stanford University's Graduate School of Education. This endeavor was made possible by Stanford's Transforming Learning Accelerator, an initiative born out of Stanford's long-range vision and the Graduate School of Education. Welcome, everyone. I am really excited to start off our first conversation. My name is Christine Bywater, and I am a professional development associate at the Center to Support Excellence in Teaching at Stanford's Graduate School of Education. This is our first conversation for the series Normal Was Never Good Enough, Resisting the Return to What Was. And I want to start by first acknowledging that I am broadcasting from my home in Pacifica, which sits on the unceded territory of the Romatush Ohlone, who are the past, present, and future caretakers of this land. We are guests here and recognize that we benefit from living and working on their ancestral homeland. It is a privilege to call this my home, and I wish to pay my respects by acknowledging the ancestors, elders, and relatives of the Romatush community and by affirming their sovereign rights as First Peoples. Additionally, the Center to Support Excellence in Teaching, CSET, is committed to engaging in meaningful conversations around timely topics. And this effort and these three conversations is indebted to the groundwork laid by Nicole Luciani Elliott and Dr. Michael Hines, who developed the structure and format of which we are using for this series. Their podcast, Teaching to Meet the Moment, is available to stream on our CSET website.
Thanks, Christine. I'm Janet Carlson. I'm the faculty director of the Center to Support Excellence in Teaching, and I'm excited to be here with you this afternoon and evening with our guests as we engage in this series of webinars converted to podcasts that engage us all in a conversation about the future we want for schools, kids, teachers, and the families that engage in those communities. I'm broadcasting from my home on the campus of Stanford University, and I would like to add a recognition that Stanford does sit on the ancestral land of the Wekma Ohlone tribe. This land is of great importance to the Ohlone people and has been since time immemorial. Consistent with the values that we hold at CSET, building community and centering diversity, the same values that are driving today's conversation, I believe we have a responsibility to acknowledge, honor, and make visible the university's relationship to Native peoples. As we transition to the focus of today's conversation, I'll start by noting the good that schools can do in our communities is irreplaceable. Schools are not just places of learning, but also serve as resource hubs that provide connections and opportunities for youth and families beyond what we typically think of in terms of classroom instruction. When schools across the nation closed their doors a year ago and went online in response to the spread of COVID-19, many students and their families lost access to this critical resource. The past year has been difficult for many. The students who felt isolated, families who lost access to the resources at the school, the educators who had to figure out how to teach from a distance, the parents who struggled and adapted to a broad range of challenges that included changes in their children's care situation to possibly being unemployed. And any of these situations could have been made worse by the pandemic.
And now, as districts across the United States are beginning the long process of getting students and educators back to in-person school, without careful attention to equity and a focus on relationships, mental health, and healing, the return to school risks further failing to deliver on the promise of an equal education for all, especially for historically marginalized students of color, English learners, LGBTQ students, rural students, and students in low-income communities. So today, we are so privileged to be joined by three guests to help us understand and take action for a restorative restart for schools in the fall, starting with the centering of relationships. I will introduce our first guest, Hayen Kimner. Dr. Hayen Kimner is an educational practitioner, researcher, and policy advocate with a focus on community school systems and partnerships. Currently, Hayen is the interim executive director of Parents for Public Schools of San Francisco and also a senior policy and research fellow for policy analysis for California Education, otherwise known as PACE. Thank you for joining us, Hayen.
Thanks. I'm so glad to be here.
Our second guest is Guthrie Fleischman. Guthrie was born on a hippie commune in Taos, New Mexico, and raised in Berkeley, California, by a single mother within that commune. He began teaching history at Kennedy High School in South Richmond, California in 2004, and has been in the West Contra Costa Unified School District ever since. Guthrie is currently a sixth-year principal at Juan Crespi Middle School and soon to be Dr. Guthrie Fleischman as he pursues his doctoral candidate in Cohort 1 of the Leaders for Equity and Democracy LEAD program at UCSB GSE beginning in July. He sees this pandemic as a once-in-a-century moment. We have to overhaul schools, so we need to seize this opportunity to reimagine school systems. And we are so honored he has time to spend with us today.
Thank you so much. Good afternoon. And I am sitting on Chochenyo Ohlone land right now. And slight clarification, UC Berkeley, not UCSB program. But thank you.
And our third guest today is Dr. Heather Huff, who is the executive director of the Policy Analysis for California Education, also known as PACE. In this role, Heather focuses on bridging the gap between research, policy, and practice, working with scholars in California's leading universities and with state and local decision makers to increase the impact of academic research on educational policy in California. And we are honored to have Heather join us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Welcome. So PACE has been working with a wide-ranging coalition in organizations that represent education, research, and community across California to develop and introduce a new framework based on the research and lived experiences for schools outlining a restorative restart for public education as students return to their campuses in the wake of the COVID-19 pandemic. Heather is going to introduce us to some key ideas from that framework, and that'll be our launching point for our conversation about how we resist a return to what was.
Like Janet said, we've been working in very deep partnership with a wide range of experts and constituents across the state with the goal of building consensus. What do we want schools to look like when we come back to school in the fall? What are all of the pieces that we want to be moving in the same direction? And the framework is up there on the screen, but I'm just going to step back for a little bit and put some color on the opportunity. So the introduction really did lay out, I think, what some of the challenges are. The pandemic has really led to an educational crisis in California. Our systems were already highly inequitable, and the pandemic has widened gaps. It's increased inequities. It has really made apparent to everyone what maybe wasn't as apparent before, which is that our systems don't serve all kids and they don't serve all families. They don't serve all communities. So we know that students have fallen behind academically. In fact, PACE research and a large deal of other research has shown that students are somewhere between 5 and 30% behind where we would expect them to be in a normal year. We also know that many students have been disengaged from school. Their mental health and wellness are suffering. And we also know that the problems are worse for students with disabilities, for those learning English, for low-income students, Black and Latinx students, and our youngest students who've had a very difficult time being served by distance learning and who've been disproportionately affected by the effects of the pandemic more generally. So we know that there's a problem that needs to be solved and that it needs to be solved with aggressive action. That's where part of the opportunity comes in. There's been a huge infusion of federal money into education and state money here in California for addressing this problem. That funding is unprecedented and it's also one-time money, which means that it brings with it some interesting challenges for how we think about allocating it. But part of the opportunity here is that everything about the status quo has been broken. So we have to rebuild. We know that there have been these huge innovative changes in education that many folks across the field have been pushing for many years. I think a great example of this is integrating technology and digital learning into classrooms. This is something that just really wasn't happening at the speed that it could have been, given the developments in the tech industry, the developments in curriculum, and to support teaching and learning. And it happened very quickly. We had students, every student has a computer. Every classroom has the kinds of licenses they need for personalized learning, for computer adaptive learning, for formative assessment. So this combination of need, of opportunity with the funds, and the need to really take stock of what isn't working and what is and build something new means that what we have to do now is both act aggressively to solve the problem at hand. Students will fall further and further behind without dramatic support, dramatic investment now. But that investment has to be in building a long-term sustainable path toward reimagining our schools to make them places where all students get the support that they need. And so in this broad coalition that we built across the state that included students and families and teachers and administrators all across the system, all different types of people with different types of goals and interests, part of what this process was very inspirational because there's been so much discordance in the field. And part of what we realized in these conversations is we all really do want the same things. We might disagree about how to get there, but there's a lot of coherence. There's a lot of agreement in terms of what people want from the system. And that's our North Star. That's what we all need to build toward. So what we'll talk about here is the focus on what school needs to look like for students. But I think it's important to also acknowledge that every educator has had a very difficult year as well. And so the idea that, that we need to focus on rebuilding, we need to focus on restorative practice, that's for students and families and for educators as well. It's bringing us all together. So this five-part framework, it starts with relationships. Because people have been out of school, because they've been disengaged from one another, because they don't have the school-based relationships or often community-based relationships that they had. When we think about opening the doors back up and bringing everyone in person, we have to start with that relational focus. And that has to include, first and foremost, really hearing and listening and learning from each other about what experiences were during the pandemic and what people want from schools. It has to start with parent and family engagement and student engagement. Many students have struggled in their time out of school, but many students have thrived in their time out of school as well. They've taken on new responsibilities, they've developed new resiliencies, new skills, and have a new type of agency in their life maybe than they had before. So really learning about all of that, what's been hard, what's been beautiful, what they want to keep, what they want to get rid of, that's really important. And then providing dedicated time and space right at the beginning of the year, but as the year continues, for cultivating those relationships in very intentional ways and in very casual ways. So making sure that there are opportunities for people to engage in play, making sure that there are opportunities for people to engage in really authentic ways, and also resetting those norms for behavior. All of us, those of us who work with kids, who have kids, know that students very quickly can forget or willfully ignore expectations about behavior. And so resetting those norms, co-creating those norms, and in creating very restorative and positive practices for making sure that when those norms are violated, students aren't disciplined, they're not punished, they're not excluded. But that's really treated as an opportunity to bring them in. But this framework is about accelerating learning. It starts with relationships because in the science of learning and development, we know that without that, without having all of your needs met, you cannot thrive, you cannot learn. But so the second piece of this is really being deliberate about assessing and then addressing whole child needs. This includes things like student wellness screenings and mental health screenings, but also language and academic needs. Did their language development fall behind during the pandemic? How are they doing in math and reading and critical thinking skills? And this should include creating new types of formative assessments and new types of screeners, but also reviewing past data. We know a lot or can deduce a lot from the past year of the pandemic. Were students logging on? Were they turning on their video? How often were they completing assignments? That kind of information will be really helpful. And then creating a plan for each child. What does each child need to fully engage back in school and to meet their full potential? Which brings us to number three. Most schools in California are not sufficiently staffed currently to be able to meet the needs of students when they come back. California schools have been historically underfunded for many years. And as a result, we have the fewest number of adults in almost every position, the fewest number of teachers per child, fewest number of counselors, librarians, school nurses, mental health providers. So thinking really deliberately about how we're going to get people into the schools to provide things like mental health supports, restorative practice, expanded learning opportunities, high dosage tutoring. A key strategy here is working with community-based partners who can often provide that type of support without hiring and increasing those personnel, long-term personnel costs. But also the people who work for community-based organizations often have a kind of training and a kind of diversity that more reflects the communities that they serve. It's also critical to attend to the basic practice of teaching and learning within every classroom. So this transformation in education can't be modular. It can't be high dosage tutoring and counseling as something that we can put on top of the system, although those things are critical. It also has to attend to the fundamental underlying work of school, which is the teaching and learning that happens in every classroom. So how can we support educators to prioritize equity and racial and cultural and linguistic relevance, to make sure that the coursework that all students receive is rigorous, to make sure that students are given agency in their learning so that they can choose the topics that they dig into and develop expertise in the things that they're passionate about? And how can we make sure that we focus on priority standards so that we're accelerating and not remediating? And finally, none of this is possible without really empowering teams to reimagine and rebuild systems. So at the school and district level, giving leaders the time and space to make plans that meet students' needs, evaluate those plans, make changes if those plans aren't resulting in the kinds of supports that are needed for students and families, and to be able to develop those relationships amongst the adults to do this very difficult and critically important work. So Janet, I'll turn it back to you for conversation.
Thanks, Heather. I appreciate the overview of the complicated framework that you did so elegantly. Christine, I think you're going to ask the first question.
Thank you, Heather. Over the three sets of conversations we have planned, we're going to discuss and explore with different guests particular parts of the framework Heather shared. But today's focus, we're really going to dive into what she was talking about in terms of centering relationships. So if you're listening to this on the podcast, the visual Heather shared is available on the CSET Instagram. We'll also have it posted next to where you stream the podcast. And Heather gave us the framing and some examples around the importance of centering relationships. But I'd like to start with you, Guthrie, as our in-house practitioner that's among our guests today. From your experience, how can leaders, parents, students, school staff, and other teachers use the idea of centering relationships, particularly at the beginning of the 2021-2022 school year, to counteract the burnout and stress so many teachers have experienced this year?
First, I think I really appreciated this brief and those five kind of pillars of how we can move forward. Although I think you could put relationships as the first, and then after the second one, you could plug it in again there, and then plug it in after the third, fourth, and the fifth. And really, relationships can kind of go across all of this, because none of those things are going to work without relationships, right? You can't push in the classroom without a strong relationship with students. I think the biggest thing that we need to do is give grace. I know it's become kind of a buzzword over the last few months, but those, you know, buzzwords come about for a reason. And everybody, you know, every single one of us is going through so much right now and has gone through so much over the last 14 months that we've got to give each other grace. Principals need to give teachers grace. Teachers need to give principals grace. We all need to give each other grace. We need to give students grace, et cetera. So that's the first thing. And a big part of that is that over the last 14 months, many of us have really not stopped working. You know, a lot of educators, you know, site leaders, teachers spent all of last summer trying to figure out what they were going to do in the fall. And in many cases, didn't know what school was even going to look like. Didn't know if we're going to be full-time distance still, if there was going to be a hybrid or those type of things. So everybody is really stretched to their absolute capacity. So certainly finding ways to encourage each other to really unplug and like really, really unplug and not check text messages and emails and voicemails and whatnot. And right now I can tell that my team at the school are laughing at me because they give me a hard time for texting at early morning and the wrong time. So I'm gonna work on that. The other thing I think for site leaders that's really important between now and August is to really, really invest time and energy into planning. We have to, with our site leadership teams, our instructional leadership teams, our, you know, faculty councils, whatever other bodies that you have at the site, really make sure that you've planned out like those in-service days in August to be as efficient and effective as possible. The last thing that anybody needs is meetings for the sake of meetings at this point, right? So that time that we do have, which in most cases is going to be pretty limited, really, really has to be productive and really has to be inspiring and fill folks up because everybody's so empty, right? And so make sure that we're planning to not, you know, go stand in front and talk at our staff for 3 hours on the in-service day, right? But really have it be, like you said, restorative and relationship building. Let's start by planning a really, really invigorating beginning to the school year that fills the teachers up and gets them ready to start with kids to do the same thing, right? So that they can be restorative with their students, so that they can start on relationships. And then the last thing I would just say that we need to really be developing like a mindful and a caring and humane expectations. Like if we go in the fall and we expect, like you said, if we expect that we're going to go back to the old normal, if the old normal didn't work, right? So we need to be developing a plan and expectations that are centered on like human connection, relationship, not on how are we going to teach every single standard, you know, in the Common Core this year.
Thank you, Guthrie. I think your reminders about us as humans and the thoughtfulness as a principal that you approach the work is definitely something that needs to be heard louder. I think your lean towards giving grace and remembering that we are all humans going through the human experience, whatever role we are in schools, is really the foundational piece for how this work gets started. So, hey, and in the work that you do and coming off of what Guthrie says, what are other ways you've seen school communities recenter relationships? I also saw the question about and how do we do that if maybe we weren't working together really well before this and now even worse maybe during this?
I think one of the biggest challenges to any sort of social movement building and transformative change right now is also the media cycle, right? The media cycle is not conducive to relationship building, to having grace, to really understanding what Heather spoke about in terms of we all want the same thing. There is the divisiveness that has come about, not only because of COVID, but certainly that has been brewing for, I would say, even the last decade, is detrimental to strong public schools and strong communities. I think the other piece, especially as we look forward and see the resources that are coming down from the federal level and the state, there is a sense of urgency, but that urgency can't skip over the relationships. You can't buy services and outsource relationships. Those services, those opportunities are not going to generate the type of trust that is absolutely needed right now. I think the term that I read somewhere over the last week was school hesitancy. When we're thinking about how students and families are thinking about a return to school, and particularly for those families and communities where distrust of a school system is deep and generational and speaks to a very real and traumatizing lived experience of what it is like. So I think those are pieces that we need to take time and pause in order to really build relationships around.
Hey, and I'm going to pick your brain a little bit more. I know you're thoroughly committed to school and community as a one noun, two words, but one noun. And I'd like to see if you just do a deep dive on one or two practices that you think really are critical for supporting that restorative start. I have in mind home visits if you wanted to unpack that, but if that's not the direction you want to go, feel free to take the question wherever you'd like.
Sure. I mean, I think wherever you start, right, there's many ways into this conversation. There are some schools that really come to thinking about community schools and community school partnerships because of a traumatizing event. There are some that come because of academic concerns. There are some that come because they don't have money for expanded learning. Ultimately, if this is about centering relationships, the notion and the practice of teacher home visits is really exciting. And the Parent Teacher Home Visit Program, that is a national program that started in Sacramento, has really built on this idea that the relationship that is most important to families is of their child's teacher. They don't necessarily want to just have the relationship with the family liaison if your school or your district is fortunate enough to have that type of staffing. They want to know, who is it that's trying to understand the curiosities of my child? Who has to deal with some of the personality quirks of their child? That's the teacher. And the Parent Teacher Home Visit Program was actually started by community organizers. And it was a community organizing model to really just build that relationship. And when they did an evaluation a couple of years back, one of the biggest findings of the impact of the Parent Teacher Home Visit was that explicitly recognizing, addressing, and starting to confront some of the implicit biases that teachers had with regards to their students and their families, and being able to unpack that to really see that and create the vulnerability and safety for teachers to really examine how they understand their young people, as well as for families to be able to build that trust and relationship. I think it's core. You can't do any of the other stuff. You're not going to trust a social worker. All of the stigma, particularly around some of the wellness, around some of the wellness issues. So I think the parent-teacher home visit, there's a lot that goes into being thoughtful about it, but at its core, it is recognizing that a parent-teacher home visit program is not a wraparound model to help families. It's a teaching, it's an instructional strategy. It is a community building strategy for teachers to be working with one another. And it is helping to really strengthen that core relationship between a student and their teacher.
Thanks. Just gives me pause. My sister's a preschool teacher, and home visits are a key part of most preschool starts to the year. And I remember just being so surprised as a high school science teacher that she was doing that, because I was taught when you contact parents is when you've had a problem with the student. Yeah. And what you're offering us is a completely different way to think about it.
I was just working on a piece with the Advancement Project and thinking about what early learning can tell us in terms of what our young people need, right? 3-year-olds turn into 4-year-olds who really turn into 17-year-olds, right? And these, the premises of the way that we design early childhood learning environments are the same. Students are, these young people are individual learners. They learn differently. They have assets to bear. You want to learn about their families. Their families have a lot of knowledge to help this young, this little person learn how to learn. Those things don't change once they're 7 or 17. And I think that the more that I've been diving into some of the work around early childhood learning and the core sort of guiding principles that research will tell us about, you know, what are the qualities of high quality early care, it's completely relationship centered. And I think that is true.
Yeah, humans are human beings, whether they're 3, 7, or 17.
Yeah, for better or for worse.
Yeah, right. Guthrie, I'm going to use that segue or to segue to you and thinking about our beings who are in their teens, like those at your school. Could you talk a little bit about restorative practices at your school, and in particular, how do you leverage the expertise that your teachers have to respond to the needs of your school community?
Definitely. Can I go back to that point about the home visits though a little bit? Because I'm
absolutely
super. So one of the things that kind of conversations that have come up a lot in digging into full service community schools is kind of a comparison to where schools are now compared to pre-Brown versus the Board of Education, particularly in Black schools in the South, because what we have right now in schools like in here in Richmond, and I mean really across America, is you have a predominantly the teaching core doesn't come from the community in which they teach, right? And so then it necessitates something like a home visit program. Right. Pre-Brown versus the Board of Education, schools were insular. And you can read folks like bell hooks and a lot of people that talk about. And in fact, one of the teachers at my school grew up in segregated schools in the South and then talks about, you know, being forced integrated into integrated schools and how detrimental that was to a lot of students and communities. And I love the work that you're doing, Hayden, because those home visits are, you know, invaluable. That's you can't, if I'm not willing to walk across the threshold into your home, then how should you trust your child to walk across the threshold into my classroom? Right. And so I think it's invaluable, but it's also, it speaks to like the incongruence that we have right now in the people that are educating the children with the children themselves. And so that's, I really appreciate this conversation because like we said, we have to totally reimagine because what was didn't work. Right. And so if we try to go back to that, it's going to still not work. So as you were talking, hey, and it just kind of that sparked up for me a little bit. You asked about like the expertise of teachers and educators. At my school site, when we say educator, every adult that walks into the building is an educator. Classified staff, certificated staff, principal, teacher, you know, front office, site supervisors, everybody in the building is an educator, volunteers. And so the biggest expertise that I feel like we've leaned into has been creativity and imagination. Because we were essentially asked in March of a school year to forget everything that we had ever learned in our credentialing programs, in our tier two programs, you know, in our staff development, everything that we had learned about how to teach went out the window, and we had to learn on the fly how to do something completely different. And if you don't think it's completely different, go sit in on a Zoom class, right? I've subbed some classes. I've sat in. It's just not the same thing, right? And so. What I have seen at my school site is just really creative and imaginative educators who've come up with some really brilliant ideas, use some of these online resources that have become available, and then shared them across the staff, right? You know, people identify a particular online resource that works well, helps to deliver content in the Zoom format, which And by the way, you know, we talked about this a lot. Last week was Teacher Appreciation Week. If you've never tried to teach to a screen of 30 black squares with names in them, you know, it's heartbreaking. You know, I've watched teachers like spend hours on lesson plans and then have, you know, come in, and then it's, there's not as the give and take is not there. The relationship is so difficult. So really the creativity and imagination has been huge. You know, it's the only way that fathomably somebody could have March 13th or 12th was the last day of school. And then Monday you're teaching in distance learning. And I think we had like a day and a half to prep and to just get folks on Google Classroom and stuff like that. So that's for me the biggest expertise that has been, you know, so important. Is just the ability to think and imagine something being different. I shared a poem with you guys, Imagine the Angels of Bread by Martina Spada. If you haven't read it, go read it. If you, you know, go find it on YouTube. He reads it. There's a couple of him reading it himself. There's also a couple really, really brilliant other folks reading it in different venues. Fantastic poem. But the premise is basically just every great change that has happened in the world or could happen starts with the idea that it doesn't have to be this way. Right. And so just to get through what we've been through and then now to think going forward. And that's a lot of what we've also been doing at the site is just we've had this year, like, how can we be drastically different next year than what we were before? And that's been kind of, you know, I tell my staff all the time, like those our Friday afternoon sessions where we're with the whole staff has been like the highlight of my year because it's like invigorating. We're like, it's inspiring. Like we're really thinking about ways that this could be totally different. And, you know, the educators at the site have come up with some really brilliant ideas and, you know, really exciting for next year.
I will say, Guthrie, that one of the, I think, missed opportunities that happens quite often is that while there is really exciting community building happening amongst instructional leaders, parents don't get insight into that, right? And so some of this distrust that is happening is felt by parents who don't have access to hearing or understanding what is happening with teachers, which is sort of to your question, Janet, another reason, you know, to really invest in those teacher and caregiver relationships, because parents that we know, and there was a question around what's been happening in San Francisco, there isn't a lot of grace, there isn't a lot of generosity, there isn't a lot of understanding around how these decisions take place. And folks are really tired, and I think that is a hard place to be building relationships from. But that kind of excitement, you know, I would want my child to be taught by a teacher who feels excited by the challenge. Granted, that teacher is also probably really burnt out, but that is a parent that I feel confident that teacher is really stretching, you know, their limits in terms of imagination and engagement and trying to really reach the black square that is my child to do that. So I do think that is a really important relationship to be able to sort of crack open and to share some of that excitement in a place where right now I think folks are generally losing patience.
I want to add to that too. But I think the relationships between adults in these systems really need restorative practice as well. In the development of our brief, I talked with a school district superintendent who had been through a big and very unpleasant strike some number of years back, and said that, you know, in the context of that, this person was attacked and belittled and called names by the union. And, you know, it wasn't friendly the other direction either. And they thought, how will we ever work together after this? But what this person told me is that, and I think we all know this in our personal and professional relationships, that kind of conflict actually can produce the best kind of growth if you lean into it and you use it as an opportunity for healing. So I can say that the worst thing we could do, and these, especially in districts, and I think this is true of most districts across the state where trust has been broken, is not to pretend like trust hasn't been broken, right? If we go back and say, school's open now, we're never gonna talk again about what happened over the past year, people will carry that resentment and they'll carry that mistrust forever. And so we have to start by saying, we know that we haven't done what you wanted, or that you're frustrated with our response, or, you know, we know that we've been working so hard, but that you haven't felt like it was enough, right? Like, there's so much that's going on that has to be unpacked. And I think that when people really listen to each other, you know, it's hard to not talk to a teacher and understand what that teacher has been going through. But again, back to Haynes Media point, you know, like, When the teacher is given a different face and a different perspective and their story is being told through a different lens, then it's easier to paint people in these kind of rigid roles. And so I think that's just a really critical piece. But then also, I think to the point about how we rebuild that trust, there, some of the expectation about what school is has been completely disrupted over the past year. And we've spoken to a lot of families and community organizations that represent families who've said, school wasn't working for us before, and we went because we had to. We didn't feel safe at school. We didn't feel served by school. And we've realized we don't have to go anymore. And now we're not going to unless we get something different. And so really listening to that perspective and trying to understand what they're saying. And I know in our conversations with students and families, I think it's harder for them to say what they want school to look like because they've never felt it before. But what they say is, here's what I don't want it to feel like, or I want to feel seen. I want to feel heard. I want people to, like, I want to have fun. I want to know that what I'm doing here is meaningful, right? To Janet's point about us all just being human, like, that's what we all want. We don't want to be in spaces where we don't feel valued or seen or have real relationships. But what that ends up looking like might look really different in different places. So it could be a much more dramatic re-envisioning than I think any of us are really prepared for yet.
That's a good point, Heather. Do you want to add something?
Yeah, just it's just, and back to the media cycle thing. Like, in April of 2020, the news, like, the narrative was teachers are the heroes, right? Everybody, you know, heap the praise, teachers are doing. And then a year later, April 2021, you're seeing all these things about how teachers are, like, all these, I'm not going to repeat them, but all these pejoratives about teachers who are just, you know, many were afraid because the systems weren't in place to make sure that everybody was safe, afraid for themselves, afraid for their students, and had real legitimate concerns with regard to reopening schools, you know. And but then here's this media cycle that shifts the narrative to really a pejorative one regarding educators, you know. And so it speaks exactly to what Hayne was saying. And then Heather, to the other point, I've been in four different schools in my career over 18 years or so now that I've been doing this. And the relationships between the adults almost invariably dictate the way that children treat each other and how they treat the adults. When adults are kind and caring and loving and supportive of one another and trusting and have positive relationships and work through the difficulties, children follow suit. When adults are at each other's throats, and when there's backbiting, and when there's rumor mills, and when all of those things, and it's tense and it's toxic, and nobody wants to come to work, and there's, you know, period subbing here and all over the place because people are calling out at 8:15 because they just can't bear to go into that space again that day, it filters to the kids, and you see those same behaviors from children.
Yeah, it's a toxic work environment for them. It's a toxic learning environment. It's the same for those of us who have to experience as workplaces like that.
So a theme that I pick up across not just what our guests today have talked about, but also in the comments, is this sense, and I'm going to paraphrase from a comment that Christine Hatcher has shared in the comment box to us. We're in the position of restoring what we neglected. So I would begin to argue, maybe restore is not the only thing we have to do. Maybe building what should be and could be is one of the pieces that goes with restore and reimagine, which is the dual title of the framework that Heather shared. I know that this conversation is really just getting started. So I have the unfortunate job of beginning to wrap us up. And as we wrap up today, the beginning of a series, I do want to return to the title, Normal Was Never Good Enough, Resisting the Return to What Was. Every one of our guests and all of our commenters have made that point. So now our job is to find the strength to make sure that none of us return to that normal that disserved so many children and so many families. In order to avoid a return to normal, we have to resist the pull of what's familiar and, for many people, what's comfortable. We have to carefully and consciously choose a restorative restart. We have to reimagine that restart. And so with that in mind, we've asked each of our guests to offer one final nugget, emphasis on nugget, that offers an action anyone listening to the webinar or the podcast can take that will help change schooling in the U.S. to build something new that invests in staff, that deepens partnerships, and allows us, and basically commands us, to prioritize racial, linguistic, ethnic, cultural relevance and rigor so that students, families, and educators feel safe, known, and supported by that start we're going to have this coming fall.
So for each of our guests, we'd like you to respond to something by saying, when you think of a restorative restart, or I think as we're starting to rename it, building what should be and could be, and you particularly think about next year, what's the thing you'd most like to bring into the work or make sure we don't continue doing to build an education system that operates equitably?
When you're thinking about a restorative restart, I would encourage folks to make sure that we're talking about the system. The system has contributed to the results that we currently have. The system contributed to the inequities due to COVID. And this is not just the education system. Our health and human services agencies are not paying for, providing the resources for, the healthcare and the wellness supports that children and families need. That is a massive systems failure that must be addressed. We can't look at the billions of dollars that are coming to California and think that we can buy our way out of this and hope for systems change. Those conversations have to start with the first dollar that's spent.
Schools operate as an island right now in communities like Richmond. We've done a lot of work, but we have a lot more work to do in our district and in all districts, I think, to get off of that island and just be infused and be a part of the community, not just in homes, but in the community, right? And not just, you know, drive in from you know, my apartment near Lake Merritt, or not just drive in from Moran or wherever it is that I live, but really infuse myself into the community in which I'm working and serving, and it's the only way to integrate. You know, not only the school itself as an institution needs to be integrated as part of the community, not an island in the community, but the people that work in the school need to be a part of the community. And really, honestly, we're talking about the certificated staff. The classified staff live in the community. Most of the classified staff in our district went to school in this district, live in Richmond or the surrounding area, and children go to school in the district, right? So it's a challenge for us as the folks that by and large, and there are many teachers and certificated staff in the district who fit that, you know, as well, but there's also a lot who don't, myself included. I don't live in the district, didn't go to school in the district. My kids don't go to school in the district. So it's on us to be more infused and engaged and build stronger relationships within the community and to not be an island, but to be an asset and a real integral part of any community. And to the point that Richard made earlier in the chat, I did want to respond to that. Yes, get resources to schools. We're talking about full service community schools, but if the funds aren't there, you can't bring the resources to the school. So yes, CBOs, please reach out to schools, reach out to districts, in-kind services, and you know, those with their hands on the purse strings, let's get more money to schools and to districts for these programs.
So what I'll add to those amazing things is, I think we all need to take the responsibility right now for building the groundwork for a higher level of funding in public education. And part of that is making sure that we spend this money really, really well. That if at the end of this period, we're able to say, look at all the things we were able to do with this one-time infusion of money, that, by the way, doesn't even get California to a level of what we research has determined is the adequate level of funding. But let's imagine a world in which we do it. We support our students with mental health supports and all of the adults that can help them thrive and the tutoring and the play and the joy. And imagine what we would feel and what kinds of outcomes we would have. And then demand, we cannot go back to what it looked like before, because before was harming our kids and our communities. But that's something that we can't wait until the end and then try to make that case. We have to be making that case right now as we're making those investments.
Yeah, I hope whatever we all just discussed in these 40, 58 minutes comes true. And in 1 year from now, we're able to have this group conversation again, and we can reflect on all of the joy, positive outcomes, the relationships that have really mattered in schools. I really hope that that's somewhere we can be in a year from now and have, as Janet has just put in the chat, joyful systematic change. So with that, that is a wrap on our first conversation. Resources from our panelists will be available online wherever you stream this podcast, as well as in the chat if you're part of our live audience. Thank you so much to our panelists, Dr. Heather Huff, Dr. Hayen Kimner, and Dr. soon-to-be Dr. Guthrie Fleischman for your thoughts, wisdom, and time. Thank you to the California-based Family and Student Engagement Organizations, the associations representing educators and system leaders, research institutes, and the civil rights and equity groups, as well as PACE, that were responsible for the development of the Reimagine and Rebuild policy brief and launched this conversation. Also, thank you to my co-host and faculty director, Janet Carlson, and our planning team, Heidi Chang, Leslie Cook, Jeannie Mung, Suzanne Burrows, and Glenn Kleiman, who we are all the front-facing, but do a lot of work on the back end to bring these conversations to you. We will be here virtually, same time next week, for the second of three conversations of our series, Normal Was Never Good Enough, Resisting the Return to What Was, where we will discuss healing teachers in service of equitable learning. I hope you can join us. In the meantime, be safe, be kind, and be well. And thank you for being a part of this conversation.